It's not clear why Atahualpa allowed Pizarro to found his settlement on the coast, or to march unhindered into the hills. With his powerful army, he could have killed all the Spaniards who were going up into the mountains, or at least the greater portion of them, reflected Pedro Pizarro, and those who escaped would have turned in a rout and would have been slain upon the road. But Atahualpa did nothing. As in Mexico, some chroniclers at the time explained this inaction with claims that the Inca believed the Spanish to be gods. But these accounts were often intended to flatter the Europeans and can't entirely be trusted. If there was initial confusion about the foreigner's divinity among the people of Peru, it's an idea that they quickly dispensed with, as Cieza de León recalls. As these Spaniards were so free from all restraint and held the honor of the people so lightly, and how shamelessly and without the fear of God they violated the virgins, the Inca began to say that such people were not sons of God, but that they were worse than Supais, which is their name of devil. The most likely answer is that Atahualpa was simply too busy to deal with the Spanish. He had just won a bitter civil war by the skin of his teeth, with his brother imprisoned and currently being transported to face judgment, and he must have been focused on securing his shaky grip on the empire. When Pizarro began his march up into the hills, Atahualpa was just then in the middle of a march of his own, a triumphal procession back to Cusco, where he intended to destroy the last remaining noble families loyal to Huascar, strip Cusco of its wealth, drag the treasure back to his home of Quito, and declare himself Emperor of the Inca. The arrival of this small group of foreigners was certainly a curiosity for him, but there's no indication he considered their tiny force to be a threat. Taitu Kusi recalls that Atahualpa was more interested in hunting the Europeans' horses, which he believed to be a new kind of llama. Atahualpa agreed to meet with the Spanish and sent an envoy of guides with instructions to lead them to the small town of Cajamarca, where, as part of his victory tour, he was already scheduled to conduct a coming-of-age ritual in which he presented ceremonial weapons to local youths. Agreeing to meet the Spaniards was a show of good faith, but Atahualpa also wanted to give them a show of force. In the heart of his empire, faced with the full might of his army, any aggression by these mysterious foreigners could be swiftly crushed. It seems Atahualpa quite reasonably expected to make Pizarro his subject, and if that didn't work, to kill him. But things would not go according to his plan. Pizarro and his men traveled slowly along the Inca roads, passing inland through the desert forests of the Amotape Hills and stopping at Inca towns and storehouses. They were supported by a team of enslaved men and women from Africa and Central America and by some local soldiers and porters that they had either convinced or forced to follow them. On their way, they were impressed with the paved roads and saw the desert landscape watered by extensive irrigation systems, with crops and animals in abundance. As they climbed higher into the mountains, they marveled at the sophisticated bridges that crossed the tumultuous mountain rivers. They also learned more about the lands ahead, sometimes through torturing locals, or from minor lords who hated Atahualpa and wanted to see him fall. They found out that this king, Atahualpa, had a vast army and heard about the recent violent civil war. They even saw the bodies of men hanging by their feet at the entrance of one town, executed as a punishment for backing the losing side. Despite all these warnings, Pizarro decided that he would meet this Inca king and take him prisoner. In this plan, Pizarro was clearly imitating the example of Cortés and his legendary capture of Moctezuma. But Cortes hadn't invented this tactic, and the taking of native hostages was extremely common among the early colonists of the Americas. Pizarro himself likely had a long history of kidnap and ransom during his time in Nicaragua and Panama, and if this king Atahualpa was as rich as Pizarro had heard, then he could expect his ransom to be truly enormous. The journey into the high mountains was hard. It was so steep that in places they had to ascend by steps, writes Jerez. The cold is so great on these mountains that some of the horses, accustomed to the warmth of the valleys, were frostbitten. Beyond 2,500 meters, altitude sickness would have set in. At one point, food and supplies arrived from the Spanish from Atahualpa, along with his wishes that they should come to meet him soon. Finally, the Spanish found their way to the wide valley, where the town of Cajamarca stood. Surrounded by green hills, the valley bottom was marshy, fed by the waters of three rivers. On the hills surrounding the town, Pizarro and his men saw the encamped army of Emperor Atahualpa, as many as 80,000 battle-hardened men. These tough Inca soldiers would have looked with some curiosity, but also a little derision, at the ragtag group of Spanish adventurers, filthy from their weeks on the road, pink in the face and out of breath in the mountain air, many of them covered in boils from tropical diseases. The governor arrived at this town of Cajamarca on Friday, the 15th of November, 1532, at the hour of Vespers, writes Jerez. In the middle of the town, there is a great open space, surrounded by walls and houses. The governor occupied this position and sent a messenger to Atahualpa to announce his arrival. Atahualpa was still in seclusion as part of his ritual and didn't hurry out to meet the Spanish, a clear reminder about who was in charge. Meanwhile, Pizarro ordered his artillerymen to set up their cannons on the ceremonial plaza in the middle of the city. The encamped Inca army watched, somewhat perplexed, but did nothing to intervene. That night, a storm came in over the hills, bringing rain and hail. The hailstones would have plinked and plonked on the helmets of the Spanish soldiers as they encamped among the temple stones, and gazed at the lights of the Inca camp, stretching across the hills for many miles. In the morning, they went to meet with Atahualpa. At first, the Sapa Inca showed little interest in the Spaniards, and even feigned boredom. He complained that they had treated some of his people poorly on the coast, burning people alive and abusing priestesses in the temples. Pizarro denied these accusations and promised that he wanted to swear loyalty to Atahualpa and fight on his behalf. While initially suspicious, the Inca emperor soon warmed to this idea and suggested that they should go together and crush a local chief who was defying him. Pizarro happily agreed, saying that the job would take only 10 Spanish horsemen. To which boast, Atahualpa laughed in disbelief. To seal the deal, they drank maize beer together from golden cups that Pizarro must have noticed with some interest. They arranged to meet again in the Grand Plaza of Cajamarca the following day. The Spaniards spent the whole night on guard, writes Pedro Pizarro, with a fair measure of fear. As the sun rose, Pizarro prepared his ambush. He hid his cavalry inside the great halls that surrounded the plaza, while his artillery pieces were loaded and waiting to fire. But Atahualpa was in no hurry. Pizarro and his men waited and waited. Finally, as the afternoon grew late, they heard the sound of the vast Inca army drawing near. The Spanish soldiers were terrified. Many of the Spaniards made water without knowing it, out of sheer terror, remembers one. Pizarro spoke urgently to his men, saying to them all that they must be of good courage and make fortresses of their hearts, writes Jerez. He told them that, at the moment of attacking, they must come out with desperate fury and break through the enemy. For his part, Atahualpa made a number of bad decisions. He had originally planned to enter the city with a troop of well-armed elite soldiers, but his meeting with Pizarro the previous day seems to have set his mind completely at ease. At the last minute, he elected to march into Cajamarca with only his ceremonial troops and servants, many of whom were unarmed. Jerez recalls the colorful scene that unfolded before the waiting Spanish, as the Inca king entered the courtyard, resplendent in full ceremonial dress. First came a squadron of Indians dressed in a livery of different colors, like a chessboard. Next came three squadrons in different dresses, dancing and singing. Then came a number of men with armor, large metal plates, and crowns of gold and silver. Among them was Atibalaba in a litter lined with plumes of macaw's feathers of many colors and adorned with plates of gold and silver. The Inca army behind them was also arranged for a ceremony rather than battle, stretched out in a long column along the road. Many of them would not even have realized that something was wrong before it was too late. When Atahualpa and his ceremonial guard entered the plaza, Pizarro gave the order to attack. The cannons went off with a terrifying crack, and cannonballs would have whizzed into the Inca lines, smashing bodies to pulp as they went. His gunners fired into the Inca procession, and then the cavalry hiding in the temples came charging out, their bridles hung with bells to create maximum noise and confusion. The Spanish horses, guns, and cannon were three weapons that the Inca had never even imagined, and the effect of being attacked with all three at once must have frozen them in their tracks. On seeing the horses charge, many of the Indians who were in the open space fled, and such was the force with which they ran that they broke down part of the wall surrounding the square, and many fell over each other. The horsemen rode them down, killing and wounding and following in pursuit. The infantry made so good an assault upon those that remained that in a short time, most of them were put to the sword. The Spanish slaughtered as many as 7,000 Inca over the following 2 hours, as the sun set red over the city. They started killing them with the horses, the swords, or guns, like one kills sheep, without anyone being able to resist them, remembered the Inca noble Taitu Cusi. As darkness fell, Atahualpa himself was captured, and Pizarro ordered his men to fall back into the temple with their captive. We can only imagine the rage and disbelief the emperor must have felt. To have fought for so long against his brother, only to have this bolt from the blue strike him down. Jerez captures some of the emperor's mood in his account. The governor went to his lodging with his prisoner Atibalaba, despoiled of his robes, which the Spaniards had torn off in pulling him out of the litter. When Atibalaba was dressed, he made him sit near him and soothed his rage and agitation at finding himself so quickly fallen from his high estate. As the dust of battle settled, Atahualpa's shock gave way to the kind of calculations we might expect of this experienced senior statesman, and it's clear he soon began to consider how to turn the situation to his advantage. While the Spaniards kept him in captivity, he regaled them with tales of the wealth of the Inca Empire, and especially emphasized Cusco as the jewel in its crown, urging them to march there and loot it. In fact, he himself had been intending to march to Cusco and destroy it. He conveniently neglected to mention his own city of Quito, where he had been intending to move his imperial court. Jerez recounts the glorious promises that Atahualpa made to the Spanish. Atibalibar said, "I will give you gold enough to fill a room 22 feet long and 17 wide, up to a white line, which is halfway up the wall. The height would be that of a man's stature and a half." He said that up to that mark, he would fill the room with different kinds of golden vessels, such as jars, pots, vases, besides lumps and other pieces. As for silver, he said he would fill the whole chamber with it twice over. He undertook to do this in 2 months. The Spanish were all too eager to accept, and decided to stay in Cajamarca to await the emperor's bounty. To their astonishment, Atahualpa made good on his promise. Over the next 10 days, gold flooded into the town of Cajamarca from all over the empire, until the room was filled with a glittering pile of ornaments. The Inca brought many vases, jars, and pots of gold and much silver, and he said that more was on the road, writes Jerez. The governor ordered it all to be put in the house where Atahualpa had his guards, until he had accomplished what he had promised. This offer by Atahualpa is often portrayed as a desperate bid by a terrified man. But given the hand he was dealt, it was actually a remarkably clever move. In a short time, he had deduced the Spaniards' weakness, their obsession with gold. The thing that Atahualpa feared most was that his brother Huascar would escape from his imprisonment and seize the empire while he was thus inconvenienced. Filling a room of that size with gold would take many weeks, giving him the time to send word to his men to dispose of his imprisoned brother and any other nobles who could still oppose him. Atahualpa also knew his mountain kingdom well. The Spanish didn't know that the rainy season was just beginning in the Andes, and even a short delay meant that they would soon face increased snowfall and mudslides that would isolate them from their coastal supply lines. Detaining them in the relatively unimportant town of Cajamarca would slow their march on the power centers of Quito or Cusco, and when they did finally make a move, the weight of the gold would slow them down and potentially expose them to ambush. From his captivity, Atahualpa was able to spread the news across the entire empire in a matter of days. As soon as the Inca soldiers transporting his brother Huascar heard what was happening, they summarily executed their prisoner on the road. Atahualpa was now the only remaining prince with a strong claim to the throne, meaning that Pizarro would need him alive. In just a matter of days, the Sapa Inca had turned a bad situation significantly in his favor. And the best part of the deal was that the gold that poured into Cajamarca every day didn't even belong to him. His treasury in Quito remained untouched, while he directed the Spanish to exactly where to find the gold of his political rivals, his dead brother Huascar, and the noble families who had opposed him in the civil war. Atahualpa was buying his freedom while at the same time diminishing his own rivals in the kingdom. It was the work not of a desperate man, but of a shrewd political operator. The Spanish were now a weapon that the Sapa Inca could aim at will, with just a few words in the right ears. Unfortunately for Atahualpa, others would soon learn this same lesson. In the weeks that followed, his great rivals, the lords of Cusco, worked to spread rumors among the Spanish, who were becoming increasingly paranoid. During these nights, the governor and his captains never slept, remembers Jerez. Nerves were beginning to fray. These lords of Cusco convinced Pizarro that Atahualpa had an army of 200,000 marching their way, along with a horde of 30,000 cannibals, ravenous for European flesh. Apparently fearing losing control of the situation, on the 26th of July 1533, Pizarro made the rash decision to execute Atahualpa, as Jerez recalls. His sentence was that, for the treason he had committed, he should die by burning, unless he became a Christian. They brought out Atibaleba to execution, and when he came into the square, he said he would become a Christian. The governor was informed and ordered him to be baptized. The governor then ordered that he should not be burned, but that he should be fastened to a pole in the open space and strangled. This was done, and the body was left until the morning of the next day. He died with great fortitude and without showing any feeling. Without delay, he had my uncle Atahualpa brought out of prison into the open, remembers the Inca Taitu Cusi, and without any resistance, garrotted him on a pole in the middle of the square. The Spanish never made any attempt to fortify the city against an attack or prepare for battle against the massive army that was supposedly heading their way, suggesting that they had never really believed the threat. They dug a grave for Atahualpa, the last true emperor of the Inca, and left him to the worms. After the death of Atahualpa, the Spanish installed the first of many puppet emperors, one of Atahualpa's brothers named Tupac Hualpa. But he died of imported diseases in only a matter of months. Next, they crowned another brother, Manco Inca Yupanqui. He was the father of the later ruler Taitu Cusi and was loyal to the Spanish for a time. But when he saw his opening, he rebelled. He laid siege to the Spanish in Cusco in 1536, attacked the new capital of Lima, and fled to the remote jungles of Vilcabamba, where he founded a rebel state. This was the last fortress of the free Inca, and it would hold out against the Spanish here for a further 3 decades. Several puppet emperors would follow in Cusco, but none lasted very long. Some were assassinated by their own people, who looked on them as collaborators. Others escaped into the mountains and became rebel chiefs. In fact, for the next half century, the Spanish continually fought Inca insurgencies, struggling to pacify a land that they had long since declared conquered. Meanwhile, hardship spread. In 1616, the Quechuan nobleman Felipe Guaman Poma de Ayala authored a remarkable text known as his Letter to a King, which he sent to the King of Spain, Philip III. In it, he recounts the abuses and injustices of the colonialists, accompanied with illustrations he drew himself, and denounces the hardship inflicted on his people. It amounts to one of the first full-throated denunciations of the colonial system ever written by one of its subjects. Just imagine that our people were to arrive in Spain and start confiscating property, sleeping with the women and girls, chastising the men and treating everybody like pigs. What would the Spaniards do then? Even if they tried to endure their lot with resignation, they would still be liable to be arrested, tied to a pillar and flogged. And if they rebelled and attempted to kill their persecutors, they would certainly go to their death on the gallows. It is unlikely that the Spanish king ever read it. The document made its way to Denmark, where it lay undiscovered until the early 20th century. Francisco Pizarro had dreamed of surpassing Cortés in the glory of conquest, and by many measures he had succeeded. Pizarro had destroyed an empire 10 times the size of the Aztec Empire, using only about a third of the manpower, and he and his men were now rich beyond their wildest imaginings. When in ancient or modern times has so great an enterprise been undertaken by so few against so many odds, reveled Jerez, and to so varied a climate and seas, and at such great distances, conquer the unknown. But Pizarro's days of glory would be short-lived. In the 10 years that he ruled Peru, he presided over a greedy and corrupt regime that brought about the steady collapse and disintegration of Andean society. Much of the population was reduced to the level of serfs, and the Spanish systematically stripped the temples and palaces of the Inca, reusing the stones to build their own mansions and churches. The golden temple of the Coricancha in Cusco was stripped of its gold and demolished, and the convent of Santo Domingo would later be constructed over its ruins. Despite the destruction, repression, and suffering inflicted on them, the people of the Andes fought to keep their culture and history alive. One example of this is the remarkable document known as the Huarochirí Manuscript, which attempted to record all that the surviving people of Huarochirí province remembered about the myths, religious notions, and traditions of their people. Although it was compiled 70 years after the invasion, and under the direction of a Spanish cleric who believed the Inca gods to be devils, it stands as one of the principal sources of information about pre-contact Peru. Its unnamed authors introduce it as follows. If the ancestors of the people called Indians had known writing in earlier times, then the lives they lived would not have faded from view. As the mighty past of the Spanish Viracochas is visible until now, so too would theirs be. But since things are as they are, and since nothing has been written until now, I set forth here the lives of the ancestors of the Huarochirí people, who all descended from one forefather. What faith they held, how they live until now, those things and more. Village by village, it will all be written down, how they lived from their dawning age onward. As news of Pizarro's conquest spread, Spaniards from across the colonial Americas began to flock to Peru. In 1534, a large fleet of 12 ships arrived, led by Pedro de Alvarado, Cortés's captain, who had slaughtered the people of Tenochtitlan as they celebrated their festival of Toshcatl. In the more than a decade since, he had developed a reputation for even greater cruelty. He arrived in Peru with a full party of settlers, slaves, and weapons, prepared to colonize this new land. He was among the first to follow Pizarro, but he would be far from the last. Before long, Pizarro came into conflict with these new arrivals, and New Castile was plunged into civil war, which further devastated the land and what remained of the Inca cities. The reign of the conquistadors in Peru was not the enlightened rule of the glorious Christian knights that they had imagined themselves to be, but more like rival mafias fighting over territory. Fresh waves of smallpox fell upon northern Peru in the 1530s, and would be followed by others in the decades that followed, as well as epidemics of measles. They died by scores and hundreds, wrote one witness. Villages were depopulated, corpses were scattered over the fields or piled up in the houses or huts. The price of food rose to such an extent that many persons found it beyond their reach. They escaped the foul disease, but only to be wasted by famine. Despite these hardships, the free Inca of Vilcabamba soon learned to bridge the technological divide with the Spaniards. They acquired modern weapons, including arquebuses, artillery, and crossbows, and learned how to use them to great effect in guerrilla raids. By the 1540s, the rebel king Manco Inca was recorded to be skilled enough to ride a horse into battle, but these adaptations were not enough. On the 24th of June, 1572, a Spanish army led by veteran conquistador Martin Arturo de Arbieto made a final advance on the Inca's remote jungle capital. The city fell, and the last Inca king, Tupac Amaru, was captured and sentenced to be beheaded at the age of 28. On the day of his execution, 24th of September 1572, a scaffold was erected in front of the main cathedral in the central square of Cusco, draped in black cloth. As many as 15,000 people came to Cusco's central square to watch. "It was only possible to push through the streets and squares with the greatest of difficulty," wrote one chronicler. "And since there was no room left to stand, the Indians climbed the walls and roofs of the houses. If an orange had been thrown down," wrote the soldier Baltazar de Ocampo, "it could not have reached the ground anywhere, so closely were the people packed." He recounts that when Tupac Amaru mounted the scaffold, the entire crowd let out a blood-curdling wail of mourning. "The whole crowd of natives raised such a cry of grief that it seemed as if the day of judgment had come. When the Inca beheld the scene, he only raised his right hand on high and let it fall. With a lordly mind, he alone remained calm, and all the noise was followed by a silence so profound that no living soul moved, either among those who were in the square or among those at a distance. Then he spoke these final words in Quechua: Creator of the world, behold how my enemies spill my blood. With him, the Inca line came to an end." Pizarro lived a violent life, and he died a violent death. He was 63 years old in June 1541, when a group of armed men burst into his palace. They were loyal to the son of a rival conquistador whom Pizarro had once had garroted and who had sworn revenge against him. Pizarro managed to kill two of his attackers and wound a third before being stabbed in the throat and then falling to the floor, where they flocked around him and struck him again and again. One might wonder whether in those moments he thought about the Inca Emperor Atahualpa and the look in his eyes as he had been strangled against that pole in Cajamarca. Perhaps then he would have understood what that look meant: to have gained everything you had ever fought for, only to have it snatched away. The fates of other conquistadors were hardly more glamorous. One who returned home, a man named Mancio Serra de Leguizamon, would famously gamble away much of the gold he had acquired in Peru, including a golden image of the sun looted from the Coricancha temple of Cusco. "Made of a gold plaque, composed of a round face, prolonged by rays and flames," according to the chronicler de la Vega, Leguizamon was a great gambler, and he had no sooner acquired this treasure than he gambled and lost it in one night. As the Inca Empire fractured and collapsed, only those rare places that the Spaniards couldn't reach were preserved. One of these was the cloud outpost of Machu Picchu, whose location would be lost until the early 20th century. Sometime in the 1530s, the Inca Empire simply left it behind to crumble into the hillside. As the cloud rolled in over the hills day after day, mosses and lichens and creepers would grow over the walls until the immaculate terraces were completely covered. The site of Vilcabamba, the last fortress of the Inca, was also abandoned and forgotten. Today, its location is known as Espiritu Pampa, or the Plain of Ghosts. On the 2nd of July 1964, the American explorer and archaeologist Jean Savoy was the first to travel to the ruins and correctly identify it. Savoy writes about the melancholy sight, crumbling in the green twilight of the forest. Watching the first sunlight fall upon these ancient walls after a lapse of several centuries is a memorable experience. The white granite blocks, covered by thin layers of delicate lichen, take on a ghostly appearance. An ominous quiet falls over the jungle. For the first time, I realize what we have found. We are in the heart of an ancient Inca city. Is this Manco's Vilcabamba, the lost city of the Incas? For 400 years, they have remained in the realm of legend. Some even doubted they existed. But I always knew they were there, somewhere, awaiting discovery. But if he had hoped for ornate stone architecture like that of Machu Picchu or Cusco, he was disappointed. Some would expect to find cyclopean walls covered with sheets of gold, or finely cut stone of the classic Cusco style. Old Vilcabamba wasn't this at all. She was old and worn. The walls of her buildings were toppled, covered with thick, decaying vegetable matter, their foundations under tons of slide and ooze. 4 centuries of wild jungle had twisted that part which remained, but she had not lost her dignity. One could easily see she had been a great metropolis, a colossus of the jungle. A wave of melancholy swept over me. At the sight of these lonely ruins, we could be reminded of the prayers written by the first great Inca king, Pachacuti Inca Yupanqui. His songs for the prosperity and well-being of his people, written in an age when the people of the mountains still determined their own future, and the sun still shone on the Inca age. O Lord, fortunate, happy, victorious Viracocha, merciful and compassionate toward the people, before you stand your servants and the poor, to whom you have given life and put in their places. Let them be happy and blessed with their children and descendants. Let them not fall into veiled dangers along the lonely road. You who order, who fulfill what you have decreed, let them increase, so the people do not suffer, and not suffering, believe in you. Let it not frost. Let it not hail. Preserve all things in peace.